ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why do humans hold on to stuff? Oddments we don't use and yet can't quite throw out. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? I'm Annabelle Crabb. Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvalis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Casey Briggs, ABC Chief Elections and Data Analyst here on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney.
And it's great to have you back on deck, Casey. And we don't have Fran today, so we are still a party, though, I can promise you. We've had so many excellent questions about voting systems, preferences, voter demographics. We thought we would dedicate an entire episode answering them and call in the big guns. That's you, Casey.
I think there's some doozies of questions. Look, I don't know if two people technically is a party for parliamentary purposes, but for us, we can make it one today.
Stop it. Are you saying we're just independents here?
We are an informal coalition of two here on the party.
We're kind of like a small sort of factional cabal, sort of scheming, but allowing people to listen to our scheming.
Yeah, we might have a falling out through the episode.
Oh, no, and then we'll have to go back to our independent lives. Look, I think we're the perfect combo. I've decided we are anyway. We're going to give you some hot takes, analysis. Casey will go through facts and figures.
There are some really interesting questions you've lined up here, so I'm excited to dig into it.
Let's get to question time. Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I'll give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah. Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for our question time. And this week, our question comes from Maddie. Hi, Party Roomers. I've got a question for Casey. On election night, you seem to know the ins and outs of every candidate in every seat. Can you take us behind the scenes on how long it takes to prepare for an election night? How far out do you start working on a state or federal election? Thanks so much. Love the show and never miss an episode. Well, thank you very much, Maddie. Never miss one, and also tell five of your best friends to listen to it. Casey, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right, to get to election night. Like, election night's like almost the least hard bit. It's the bit before you're prepping.
Yeah, I mean, it's a full-time job, quite literally. We start working on elections a long way ahead of time. For a, you know, state election, it's months out. We're starting to work on the Victorian state election already. And that's because we have, you know, a pretty comprehensive website with a whole bunch of material that gets produced. And to be honest, writing that website, all of those electorate pages and guides that we produce, that's a lot of my research and preparation for election night. That's a lot of the ways that I kind of make sure that I know every single seat and all the suburbs and all the polling booths is in just preparing for that. But months out, we're starting to produce that material. And then in the lead into each election, obviously, there is really a lot of testing, rehearsal, preparation set up. We've got an election computer that needs a whole set of tables and spreadsheets. You know, for a large part of the lead into an election, my job becomes spreadsheet, updating all of those key setup information. We do testing. So I've just come this afternoon from testing our internal systems in our election computer for the upcoming Farrer by-election and the Nepean by-election that's happening next week in Victoria as well. We're making sure all of our graphics work. We're making sure that all of the polling places are in the system. They're in the right place. They're appearing on our maps in all the right ways. So, a lot of work, a lot of preparation to be done. And I think you just start to absorb all the facts and figures and numbers through that process.
You do. And of course, that's exactly what you do. But come on, Casey, don't underestimate it. To be able to recall like a whole bunch of candidates in some electorate, especially in a wild election now increasingly where more and more seats have become marginal, right? Like every seat's up for grabs almost. It's not like it used to be where you could rely.
You used to have 20 or 30 seats in an election that you'd say these are the key seats and they're the ones we spend 80% of our time focusing on preparing for. And that list, I mean, in South Australia of 47 seats, I think my key list of seats was about 27 seats long or something. You know, you kind of end up with far too many and many more characters as well. You're not worried about just the Labor and the Liberal candidate. You're worried about three or four or five candidates in a seat. So, yeah, you're right. There's a lot more things to be keeping across and a lot more volatility in the way things and unpredictability in the way elections are going. So it is becoming more of a challenge. I must also say it is a challenge. You know, I've been in this chief elections analyst job for a bit under a year now. It's a bit of a challenge to keep across all of the politics of not just federal politics. I have to keep across eight states and territories plus federal politics. I'm not complaining, but there is a lot of information that you're sort of staying on top of to make sure you're monitoring for all the developments and keeping on top of what you'll need to know.
I love how he's like, not complaining, although the man's about to collapse.
I love my job, but I do a lot of reading, I will say that.
You do. You've just nailed it. And kind of all of those anecdotes of knowing about, you know, we watched obviously Anthony do the job before you and you've been working on elections for a long time before you took the chief role. But, you know, just kind of being able to say, oh, this booth always votes this way, this, you know, those little details too, which just you can bring out. That's just because you're just studying all of it, aren't you? So you can sort of say, hey, this booth is always a very strong Liberal booth. Don't get too excited on these numbers, because people do that where they think, oh, wow, look at that. And of course, it's not indicative of the vote. Like, all of that takes just heaps of
Work. Of study. You remember it over time, and heaps of preparation and a good set of notes. You'll see me on an election night sometimes pick up my little handbook of notes, which I'll say little. It was 200 pages in South Australia, referring to a number or knowing, you know, I have something in my noggin that rings a bell here. I need to go and double check the figures here. A detailed set of preparation is always key. Preparation makes perfect performance.
For anything, actually.
Yes.
So not just election
night. Take that to your next job interview.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, our next question comes from Chris, and it's about the Queensland Senate.
It's Chris from Warner in Brisbane. I live in Queensland and never really thought much about one of the quirks of living here. Queensland's the only state in Australia that doesn't have a Senate. So I'd just like to get your thoughts on the pros and cons of that, as I find it a bit scary to think whatever party gets a majority can basically pass whatever legislation they like without any oversight from upper house. I'd assume it's a more efficient government with one house, but makes it difficult for smaller parties to be represented. So I'm interested to hear what you think and if a Senate should be reinstated or not. Thanks. Bye.
Well, or the lack of the Queensland Senate, that's really the question, isn't it? So, Casey, yes, it's a one house shop there, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Queensland's been a single legislative assembly lower house for more than a century. To answer the question of why, you've got to go back more than 100 years, because Queensland did once have an upper house called the Legislative Council, as they're called in most states around the country. Queensland's upper house in the 1800s and early 20th century was formulated in much the same way that the British House of Lords was. So not a democratic body. It was appointed, members appointed by the governor. And what we saw in the early decades of Queensland's parliament was a lot of clashes between the lower house and the upper house, clashing over things like the expansion of the right to vote. And it just kind of continued to become this political, you know, hot button issue. Became much more of a political issue in about 1915 during the First World War. That's when Queensland Labor came to power, the first long-term Labor government in Queensland. At that time, there were three Labor members in the Legislative Council out of 40. And so Labor had a lot of trouble getting its agenda through. The council rejected bills all the time, bills that would let the government take over and operate meatworks during the war. There were bills around adult suffrage in government election, local government elections and things like that. But a real handbrake on the Labor government's agenda at the time. And the Premier, Thomas Ryan was his name, he was not happy about it. He introduced a bill to abolish the Legislative Council that passed the Legislative Assembly. Funnily enough, the Legislative Council blocked that bill. They didn't want to abolish themselves.
Oh,
funnily enough,
twist.
Who would have thought it?
What a twist.
The Premier then tried to abolish it by referendum. That failed as well. And it kind of went away a little bit, but continued to be this sort of political issue. Labor really did not like the fact that this upper house, this unelected upper house, was getting in the way of its agenda. Over time, there were more Labor members appointed, but the governor wasn't agreeing to give enough appointments to Labor to give Labor a majority in that house. The key thing that happened was the governor retired. and then the Speaker of the Parliament was made Lieutenant Governor, and that was the crucial thing, because within weeks of that happening, 14 more Labor members were appointed to the Legislative Council, and the Labor government had a majority in that council. About a year later, the government tried again to abolish the Legislative Council. The Legislative Assembly passed it, and then it went to the upper house, and those newly appointed Labor members all, at that point, voted themselves out of a job and abolished their own chamber. These days, those Labor members that were appointed and immediately voted themselves out of existence, they're sometimes referred to as the Suicide Squad. And that is the end of the Queensland upper house. So it's a really fascinating chapter in Australian political history there. But the question from Chris also hits on really the trade-offs that we're talking about here. Efficiency in parliaments, you know, if you've only got one chamber to get things through and the government always controls
it. Definitely easier.
Much faster to get bills through.
Yeah.
But what are the drawbacks? Well,
many.
Yeah, many. I mean,
I think many
drawbacks. We've seen examples, in fact, where governments then end up hoisted on their own petard, right? They overplay their hands. John Howard, with work choices in the early 2000s, had control of both chambers of parliament. So this was a situation where he could pass anything he wanted through the Senate.
He could do whatever he wanted.
And that backfired on him. In Queensland, we've seen the Newman government, for example, in 2012, win a massive majority in parliament and then immediately lose office a term later because of the way that they handled their time in government. And we've seen examples of what can happen in a single member house when there's a lack of scrutiny, when there's a lack of those diverse voices that upper houses can bring in, the sort of handbrake and the checks and balances. Need I point out the Joe Bjelke-Petersen government of Queensland? And so where do you land on that position is sort of, you know, in some ways a political and a sort of cultural view that people will develop. Queensland, in lieu of having an upper house, has a much more established committee system than many of the other states. A lot of that came out as a result of the Fitzgerald inquiry after the Bjelke-Petersen government. Should Queensland reinstate an upper house, I mean, you'd have to get past some pretty serious practicality issues there. A whole chamber of more politicians might be a really tough line
to sell. Yeah, cost of living crisis, people being a little anti-establishment at the moment is a trend. Do you really think people are going to say yes to more politicians? No, but I agree with you. I think I'm a big fan of double houses, House of Review. I think it's a really important thing to have. Yep. Sometimes it's annoying. I mean, democracy is slower. I mean, you know, this is the thing when people say things in China are being bunged up quickly. Yeah, that they are an authoritarian communist state. That's right. Things are happening more efficiently there. That's right.
But it's a trade-off.
We are a liberal democracy.
Do you want your government to have the ability to enact any agenda it likes based on the majoritarian system? Do you want those checks? Do you want those voices? One of the drawbacks can be it does give more individual MPs in the upper house a veto power effectively. You know, people in the balance of power can veto government legislation even when they potentially represent a very small number of people. There are always pros and cons and trade-offs here in any system. I think I would guess most Australians would probably prefer the upper house to exist and be that check and balance so that we don't see those sorts of Joe Bjelke-Petersen style governments again in Australia. But I don't like the chances of Queensland going back to that kind of a world anytime soon. It'd be a lot of political capital to get that over the line.
I think it's fairly unlikely. All right, next question is a handwritten one. Well, it's not handwritten, it's typed actually, but like let's go with handwritten because I said it now. Hi, Fran and PK, and I'll add Casey. I recently started listening to the podcast and I've become obsessed. It was exactly the kind of reporting I was looking for. Well, thank you, Abby. I have a question about Gen Z voters. There's been a lot of commentary about Gen X men driving the shift to One Nation, but I expect Gen Z men to be the main movers given the global trend of young men drifting towards right-wing populism. Are Gen Z men actually still voting left like women are? And if so, why isn't that global radicalization translating into One Nation votes from the demographic the way it seems to be in other countries and among Gen X Australians? Thank you, Abby from Melbourne. Wow, that's a doozy of a question. Okay, I've got thoughts, but I'm going to go to you first, Casey.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is it is a doozy of a question. It's a pretty complicated one to answer. And one of the reasons is we don't actually have loads of data in Australia on this phenomenon, much less of it in Australia than we see in other countries. One of the reasons for that is a lot of this, this surge in One Nation support has all happened since the last federal election. And so we don't really have a baseline, other than the South Australian election in March, a baseline of a lot of this. Now, we have seen some studies around this. We've seen some polling. We've seen, you know, data points in the Australian election study that does suggest that the One Nation surge and One Nation support is being driven by Generation X and boomers more than it is Gen Z and millennials. We know that Gen Z men and Gen Z women are expressing their more progressive nature slightly differently. Women are more likely to vote Green, we think, than men. Men are more likely to be voting Labor. So there are definitely gender differences among young people. But on the whole, Generation Z is a more progressive generation than other generations. Now, why could that be? You might have some theories, PK. Some of it may be to do with our electoral system, the way that we have preferences, you know, fairly uniquely in the world, a compulsory preferential system. Partly it's around compulsory voting, a rarity around the world as well. It means that, you know, turnout and really engaged voters on the extremes are less influential in Australian politics than they are in other parts of the world. There are probably cultural and media and information system reasons for that. As well, what happens into the future with these generations are going to be very interesting, because as we all know, Gen Z is only growing in terms of its voting power in Australian politics. But I'm interested in your thoughts too.
Yeah, well, first thing, obviously, just always caveat, no generation, you know, thinks one way. It's about trends. So, you know, I know that's obvious, but I think it should be said. I always think when we talk about boomers for a long time, and lots of boomers have written to me and said, thank you for noticing this. I'm like, we talk about them like one group. There are rich boomers, there are poor boomers, there are women boomers, there are male boomers. Like, it's, you know, so Gen Z isn't just one thing. I agree they are more progressive, but I don't think that's unusual. Like, if you looked at boomers at the same age, they were progressive too. A lot of younger people are often more progressive. It's a thing, right? So there's that caveat. How men and women vote generally is that women are more left-leaning than men, including in Gen Z. So that's also reflected in Gen Z already in all the data we've seen around the world and the limited data in Australia. That's a fact. And I think that's an important thing to mention. But I think one thing I just want to say, which isn't so generational but is on gender, is that historically, actually, women used to vote for the Liberal Party in big numbers. People are surprised by that when you tell them, but they did. So actually, that's shifted. It was women who held up the Conservatives in the past. So women were not always lefty voters, were they, Casey? Like, that is not true. There's been a change.
There's been a real change, and change is potentially continuing to come. You know, I think there's a pretty strong argument that some of the shifts that we've seen among some cohorts, thinking about young men in particular, in other countries, in the US, may be in part driven by the sort of social media ecosystem. I'm not trying to blame social media for any particular, you know, thing here, but there is a more of a sort of right-wing influencer sort of culture that hasn't quite reached the same level of scale in Australia. That may change into the future. You know, the way that we consume information continues to change. So nothing is ever fixed, but it is interesting that, you know, we see, and we see this in other respects in sort of political movement and thinking, Australia often is later to other global trends than other countries are. The US is often a sort of rapid incubator of some of these things because the electoral system and the institutions move faster. You know, our system slows things down, tamps things, pushes things to the middle. You know, there are those sort of checks and balances that mean the volatility is lower in Australian politics. And so maybe we will move to that kind of a world, but we're not seeing it in the data just yet, caveated with there isn't actually all that much data. We're not, you know, there are no very, very comprehensive studies being done. There are no big, massive exit polls like you see in other countries that exist here. They're just too expensive for little old Australia to do. And so I will be very interested as we continue to track, especially this One Nation performance over the coming months and years.
Yeah, the Farah by-election, then the Victorian election, we're going to be able to test it over.
We're getting
over
more
again.
Data. Yeah, every election this year is giving us more data around how has the sort of support base of every party shifted in the past year or so?
Our next question comes from Eli.
Hi there, Eli from New Zealand. Big fan of the podcast and thanks for keeping me updated on the goings-on in Canberra. My question is around proportional voting. You have the Greens and One Nation increasingly on double-digit polling numbers, yet only have one seat each in the House. Do you think it's possible that with the change in polling, and trends over the last two elections, with votes moving from the major parties towards independent and minor parties, that the Greens, One Nation, and potentially others may begin to campaign on transitioning to proportional voting like we have here across the ditch. You would have your space for independents and seats, but you would be able to split your vote and give that number to your local rep, but give a tick to the party whose policies best represent you.
It's a really interesting question, Eli. Proportional voting, like we have across the ditch. Casey, this is so in your bailiwick.
Yeah, I mean, you'll find a lot of very, very passionate advocates of proportional representation around the country. A lot of election nerds will call themselves really firm supporters of a sort of proportional system where basically, you know, the basic idea is if you get 20% of the vote, you should get roughly 20% of the seats in Parliament. That's not what we've got at the moment. You know, the majoritarian single member system in most parliaments means if you, you know, look at Labor, you know, Labor's primary vote in the last federal election and the thumping majority that they won. Now, again, pros and cons, trade-offs of all systems. What's the actual kind of debate, though, in Australia? Well, the Greens have always been an advocate of proportional representation. They often float this idea. They are, you know, their party policy says at least one chamber in every parliament should be proportionally elected. It's never been a major plank of their platform. It's not been something they're sort of actively fighting
about. Yeah, you don't hear them banging on about it.
No one's banging on about it. One Nation have advocated for various other electoral system changes, but not so much this one. It's interesting if you look overseas, look at, you know, the UK, for example, where we're seeing similar and perhaps more rapid disintegration of the two-party system, not just with Nigel Farage's Reform UK, but also with the Greens, the Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru, the SNP, different, you know, the sort of blue and red British electoral map has all of a sudden become this like vast, very interesting colour palette across the country. A lot of people in the UK support a shift from a sort of first past the post electoral system to a proportional system where people will get elected sort of roughly in proportion to their vote. That includes Nigel Farage has been a proponent of that in the past. He's a little less keen on it, it seems, at the moment. He's not been, at least certainly not actively talking about it anywhere near as much as he used to now that the Reform Party is performing as well as it seems to be. But it's been a much more mainstream view in that country where we're seeing this sort of rapid disintegration. So it might be that we start to see that if we do end up with, you know, what's some of the polling federally saying at the moment in Victoria and in New South Wales, you know, you've got three parties on broadly similar sorts of votes. And if that continues into the future, I would expect we start to see more and more calls for this sort of a system to be implemented in Australia. Again, the difficulty and the practicalities of this, it's very hard to change these systems and the political capital is a lot to spend, but I suspect we will if this is going to keep happening, 25%, you know, across three different parties.
Yeah, and then a party can say we're consistently not being, you know, people are not getting their will expressed in the parliament if it's not delivering the results as a result of our structure. So you're right, it builds a momentum, but you do need powerful advocates.
You do need powerful advocates, and you need advocates that are going to dedicate a lot of time to this because it will be a very significant change to our system.
And we appear to have some bigger problems and bigger things to fry sometimes. All right, our next question comes from Lucy. And Lucy says, I was listening to your discussion about the possibility that Labor will recommend an increase in the number of federal MPs in line with population growth. And I just wondered if we'd be better off dismantling state parliaments, reducing cost shifts and other convenient handballs, and forcing a big picture view, and then increasing federal numbers to improve representation. One person for us to contact, irrespective of the nature of the issue, would be a simpler process than our current group of representatives, and an overall reduction in expensive MPs would help the budget. Federal MPs could still meet regularly in their state groups to discuss their local issues and decide on important subjects requiring focused attention. But how would or could this happen, says Lucy, Victorian, unimpressed with all sides of our state parliament. Lucy, that's a view I hear a lot in Victoria, so I've not first time I've heard that, Lucy. Lucy, I'm going to start with my view and then throw to Casey, because how would you, could this happen? It's not going to happen. I'm sorry, Lucy, I'm calling it. You're not going to lose your state parliaments. I can't think of anyone who would fight for that or believe in that. Also, Australia is a federation. Our state parliaments actually have, you know, look at the responsibility between state and federal governments. There are a lot of responsibilities for state governments. They do, you know, they police, schools, like they've got sort of key roles that they want to answer questions on and should be held accountable for. And the idea of just making a mega federal parliament would be seen, I think, politically as, you know, too much power for Canberra and it's not local enough. And I don't imagine that would wash well either. What do you think, Hosey?
I mean, we've got a lot of really, really interesting questions with listeners giving us really big ideas that, you know, regardless of their merits, as you say, are just practically impossible in the current political environment. But like, let's talk about it. I mean, Bob Hawke famously was a big proponent of this idea, do away with the states. We have too many levels of government. It's a pretty kind of popular idea in lots of ways. Lucy, you've raised, you know, lots of reasons, the duplication of services, the coordination issues. You know, we saw some of the difficulties during the pandemic, for example, of getting states and territories to agree on a set of principles or agree on a set of policies. And that was where we really saw the Federation sort of become much more of a federation than we'd ever seen in our living memories.
Well, we're seeing it in live time with the NDIS at the moment. The government wants to reduce the scheme. States aren't stepping up. I mean,
exactly. I mean, it would be much easier for federal governments if the states didn't exist. They could definitely do a lot more without having to have these fights about money. There are good arguments against it. You know, states are incubators of ideas often, right? Like a lot of interesting ideas have started in a small parliament or one state, and they've been tested out, and then they've expanded across the rest of the country. It's a sort of natural little laboratory of ideas that the state parliaments can try new policies and try new ideas. So there's some merit in that. The states obviously are a check on, you know, like the Senate is a check on the lower house. The states are a check on the executive federal government. Do you want your local schools and hospitals being run out of Canberra? There's, you know, maybe some decent arguments that having local knowledge and local experts and local services is a really good idea there. And then, of course, the practicalities, you know, actually doing this would be unimaginably difficult, even if you thought it was a good idea. Now, having said that, you have seen over years, and we continue to see it from time to time, moves to and successful moves to, you know, transfer power from states to the federal government. We've seen over time the states become less and less influential and powerful, and you can see the way that power is sort of exercised through funding agreements and the way that the federal kind of government can, you know, impose policies on states through that. So that's, you know, potentially more likely as the states just over time continue to become less influential, have their power kind of withdrawn through, you know, boring mechanisms like compacts and funding agreements and things like that restrict the ways that states are able to sort of exercise their independence. And we've seen that. We continue to see that. I expect we will continue to see that, you know, functionally, practically, the sort of disintegration of much of that. But, you know, I don't think prime ministers have any particular interest in taking on all of the stress and bother of running a local hospital and all of the scandals and drama and political issues that causes too.
Yeah, but that sort of local versus getting rid of duplication argument, you know, they're really live arguments that are always there, and we can see the problems in the Federation. That it's clear, and there have been many ideas to try and overcome them. Another part of your question, though, which I just want to go to briefly, is this proposal for more MPs. Now, that proposal is not about state parliaments. And it was a good question, Lucy, you put that in, but actually this proposal is just about having enough representatives to cover the growing, the bigger population. Now, I think there is a lot of democratic merit to the argument. Politically, though, it's a stinker. And we know it's a stinker because the Prime Minister came close, depends how you want to read it, when he was asked in Parliament, but, you know, he said he was very happy with the current size of the Parliament, you know, kind of poured cold water on this idea that the Minister for State, Don Farrell, has been working on. Now, how does that work? Why would a senior minister, actually a very powerful factional apparatchik, be working on an idea and then the PM pours cold water? Well, often that does happen. So they're working on something, seeing if it's possible.
Flying through kites.
Yeah. And then the politics kind of defeats you. And I think the PM's already made the call on it. I could tell, actually, in that answer. I feel like he's got very little appetite to try and expand the parliament. And it was a bit cheeky his answer too, because obviously they have a 94-seat majority.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people within the government and within the Labor Party that would like to see the parliament expanded. Think it does need to happen. I think there are a lot of people within the opposition that think at some point it does need to happen as well. And perhaps they were hoping that the government might take the political hit, because it is a bit of a difficult sell, and it's very,
because
very
politicians
easy.
Aren't popular.
Very unpopular, and it's very easy for politicians to campaign against the creation of more politicians.
Funny, isn't it?
The other element, of course, is the political context. So Don Farrell's proposal idea, terms of reference of the committee that's looking at this issue, that was said in the terms of reference of the review of the May 2025 election. That was put in place quite some time ago. The political context in Australia has shifted even during that committee process. And I think the political calculation of whether you'd want to go ahead with an expansion of the parliament in June 2025 versus April 2026 is vastly different. The potential political consequences are really massive. You know, there might be people in the government going, why would we want to create more seats in suburban Melbourne and allow Josh Frydenberg back into parliament, give him an easier route back into parliament? You know, why would we want to make it possible for more members of One Nation to be elected in the next parliament? There's lots of more political complexity. So whether this is dead just for this term of parliament or it's dead for a long time to come, I don't know. There are a lot of good arguments to increase the size. You know, the electorates are big. Australia has a small parliament compared to many of our similar nations. Very small parliament. Electorate offices get a lot of local constituency work their way. And I imagine for many it is becoming a really significant workload for them. And a great number of electorates are getting very, very large and becoming very hard for local members to represent. So I don't know if this issue goes away entirely, but certainly feels dead for the next couple of years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, unless politicians become suddenly very popular, I think it'll be very hard to pull off. But eventually, inevitably, I think there will be, you know, some push again.
At some point it probably does need to happen, but whether it happens and how big the kind of increase it is up in the air. Now, the one thing that could happen in the shorter term is a look at the territory senators, territory representation. I think that might still be on the table potentially, looking at giving the ACT and the NT 3 or 4 senators, or doing some other sort of arrangement to give them more representation in the upper house. I think that maybe hasn't quite been fully ruled out in this term of parliament, but a relatively modest change if that happens.
Mm, sounds modest. I love the word modest. It's such a good word. Well, with all of our modesty, thank you for coming into the party room and partying with me in our little faction today.
It's been a great pleasure. I think we're staying together. I think we're a united front.
I think we are united. I think I'm locked in. I'm voting your way. Let us know if you'd like more themed episodes in the future, and keep sending your questions in. We do like getting your questions, actually, and we're especially fond of those voice notes, so I can hear you and not read your questions, mainly because I don't read them as well as you say them. You can email them to theparty@abc.net.au. Remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. David Spears will be back in the feed for Insiders on Background tomorrow, speaking with John Bolton. He's Donald Trump's former national security advisor turned, well, prominent critic now. They'll discuss the latest on US-Iran peace talks, so make sure you look out for that. See you, Casey.
See you, PK.